Also, the line between what is dual use, what is civilian use, what is tailored for military use and not, again, is slightly artificial. Is that company causing, contributing, or directly linked to harm? And what processes have they got in place to understand, identify, and act on those risks and impacts that they might be connected with on that side? So you really need to be looking at that broader chain and focusing more on the due diligence elements. How it's designed, how it's developed, how it's produced, where it goes, how it's used. And underpinning all of that for all the defence-related stuff is, you know, is it used in line with international humanitarian law, the laws of armed conflict?
Welcome to Sustainability Wired, the show that plugs into the thinking that moves sustainable finance. I'm Lorenzo Sa, the Chief Sustainability Officer at Clarity AI, and I'm really excited today to cover a topic that brings together defense and sustainable investing. Yes, defense and sustainable investing. Typically, these have been seen as oxymorons a bit in the market, and I think this is changing. Is changing as we see investors and companies looking at this differently, regulators starting to actually be more upfront of saying how these things can work together, but most importantly, citizens, as they see the geopolitics around us change quite significantly. So we really wanted to capture this topic and look into this, and we thought that we really needed someone that could bring together expertise in sustainable investing with understanding of the defense sector. And that's why I'm super excited of our guest today. Dan Neal brings really that expertise of being within an investor that has a really strong background in sustainability and sustainable investing, but has had its own stints at the Royal Navy and at NATO. So Dan, it's great to have you. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Lorenzo.
Well, look, I think that's exactly where we want to delve into. It's your background. Can you tell us a little bit around the Church Commissioner, which is where you're at, and your specific role, and how you get there?
Sure. So it's a bit of a wiggly route, but so I'm the social lead within the responsible investment team at the Church Commissioners. The Church Commissioners is a in perpetuity endowment fund with £11 billion in under management. I look after then all S stuff related, so human rights, modern slavery, DEI, conflict, ethical AI, responsible tech, etc. So I've been here for 3.5 years. And if I sort of work backwards, before that, I was the social lead of the World Benchmarking Alliance, so integrating S into the SDG benchmarks that were being created there, Sustainable Development Goal benchmarks. And prior to that, I ran something called the Corporate Human Rights Benchmark, which benchmarked corporates on their human rights approaches. 5 years before that, was a social performance consultant, so mostly working in Africa and Middle East, so in different roles. Largely focused on extractives, mining, renewables, and very much of that interface of community, responsible security management, socioeconomic development, and all the bits that kind of go with it. I've got a master's in security conflict and international development. And before the consulting stuff, I spent my 20s in the British military. Started off Navy, basically on the bridge of a ship, driving ships around and doing things like counter-piracy off Somalia. But I spent a few years working with a joint army unit that did what you could call maybe post-conflict reconstruction development or sort of mid-conflict reconstruction development, so stabilization, the bit in between. And so that's working with groups like USAID and DFID, the Department for International Development, as it was, and really sort of very similar to what the things I ended up doing on the social performance consultant, right? So I've gone from sort of military through to working on human rights, and that sort of wiggly path. But at each stage, it was sort of a logical step to the next part. And a lot of it is really focused on really, you know, responsibility and particularly responsible business conduct.
Great. Your experience in the Navy, I think, with what's going on in Venezuela these days, I'm sure you have an eye for, you know, how is that even all possible? But look, I diverge. I'll kick off by looking at how these two topics, defense, sustainable investing, come together. And it's 4 years now since, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine. I think that has really shocked the world in a sense, and especially Europe, I think, in the sense of how that changes the way of thinking of security. And just recently, the U.S. has put out their national defense and foreign policy strategy, which, you know, clearly signals that Europe must prepare to a very unstable world with different threats and a very different view of how multilateral and the U.S. support might be. And that's changing, you know, how Europe is looking at defense. Since 2021, the European have increased by 23% their investments in defense. And that's also, and this is where we're going, reshaping sustainable investments. The European Commission recently recognized defense as a potential contribution to social sustainability, and even SFDR's framework has been signaled as consistent and compatible to defense. Investors are responding. We know asset managers like Allianz Global Investment, UBS, and DWS have kind of changed their exclusion policies, and even asset owners, especially in the Nordics and in Scandinavia, has now really modified their approach to sustainability. So, long story short, things are changing, and it seems like more and more investors are looking at defense as a sustainable investment. Is defense a sustainable investment?
Hopefully we keep the audience here, because I think there's an element of splitting hairs, which is actually quite important. Let's just say that most investors, like the big mainstream investors, have always been in defense. And so now there's the question about whether defense investments can stick within sustainable funds. If we talk about sustainable investing, that's basically the integration of environmental, social, and governance issues in terms of supporting long-term value and managing risk. So you can look at a defense-related company and say, yeah, I'm going to look at your ESG issues and try and improve things, maybe for a positive outcome, but also for our long-term value. So I think you can say you can do sustainable investing, but does that mean I think that defense is a sustainable investment? And that's a different part. That's the splitting hairs part around that. Now, you go back to 2015 when the SDGs came out. If there wasn't a taxonomy, if we hadn't created this whole industry, this whole sort of money machine around calling things sustainable or not, would anyone be sat there trying to argue that Rheinmetall, that, you know, the German arms manufacturer, is positive contribution to the SDGs and therefore should be a sustainable investment? Like, no one would have argued that, right? So I think this is a case of when you create a taxonomy, when you create a framework about sustainable investing and lots of money goes into that, and people want access to those funds and they want to have those growth businesses in those funds, then people start relabeling things. But yeah, I think you can be a sustainable investor and focus on defense. I don't necessarily think you can say that just because it's in that taxonomy or it's allowed by that taxonomy that therefore it's sustainable. Because if defense is sustainable, then everything's sustainable, right? And I'll get off my soapbox shortly, but defense is critical. It's necessary. It's legitimate. But so are motorways, so are the courts. That doesn't make the company that makes the judges' wigs, and that doesn't make the company that makes the tarmac sustainable investments on that side. But they have risks to look at.
Yeah. I mean, this thing about kind of taxonomies or regulatory frameworks that force that conversation might explain also, you know, how it's not only in Article 6 in Europe that you have weights in defense. You have also Article 8 and Article 9 funds that have weighting in defense. And in the last few years, in both of those categories, the weights have increased. And this signals to a change that you at the Church Commissioner have also looked at. So why this change is happening and how have you at the Church Commissioner looked at it?
So, I mean, the main driver for our change was that we were updating policies and also advice from something called the Ethical Investment Advisory Group, which gives sort of the theological underpinnings to our advice. So it's high-level advice, which we then turn into policy. But our policy was last updated on defense in 2010. Quite a lot has changed since then. The UN Guiding Principles on Business and Rights. Internal teams and capacity for that. We've gone from being a quite UK-focused investor to being a much more global investor. Our restrictions on armaments and things go back to our formation, our formal formation as a body in 1947. And they were sort of a 50% revenue threshold. And then that went to more sectors and 25%, and then a broader view and 10%. And so that it was always going to be sort of reviewed. A lot has happened in the interim period since we first started looking this a few years ago on that side. I think the way to describe how we've shifted it is two parts. One is in terms of the restrictions and the screening, and the other one is more the integration of the human rights approach for that. So again, since the last policy update, we have a human rights policy. We have staff like me and teams that can look at human rights due diligence on companies. But from the restriction side, we used to have, if you look at conventional, so ignore the controversial stuff for a moment. You look at conventional, we had like weapons companies, weapon-related parts and services, and non-weapon-related parts and services. They were all treated the same, and they were all given a 10% revenue threshold everywhere in the world. What we've sort of done is tilt that, so we've gone like that. So now, depending on the country of origin, that changes the revenue threshold. And depending on the type of company, that changes the revenue threshold. So we've tilted it one way, and then we've tilted it another way. So that UK, you know, we've removed restrictions on conventional weapons companies in the UK. And then we've made it much, much harder for, say, companies from oppressive regimes. And so we've drawn a line there. But that's just the thou shalt not. That's where the box that within that our managers can actually pick and choose companies. But on top of that is obviously our human rights due diligence approach, our controversies processes, et cetera, that really look into the companies themselves and what they do and how they approach things. So it's quite a considerable change.
So, but that seems there's a geographical element. There's also like a type element review. Is there been something around thresholds that you've changed as well? Like revenue thresholds?
Yes. So when we look at the oppressive regime companies, that's now 0%. So that's gone right down to 0% across the board. UK is 100%, i.e. there is no thresholds there. NATO plus Five Eyes, so basically NATO plus Australia and New Zealand, are at 50%. And then okay. The rest of the world is still at the 10%. So we've made it easier in some areas, closer to home, and harder in other areas where we consider those to be oppressive regimes.
Now, one of the worries I hear around approach like this is, yes, but you can sell weapons across borders.
Yeah.
Have you thought of that? And what's your response?
So I think that, you know, the thresholds and the screening is the starting point. That's just your very beginning part of that. When it comes to that, where weapons go, who they go to, how they're used or misused, and if there's leakage, that's more in the kind of the due diligence part that goes into there. So we do have some frameworks, but we are kind of lacking in some of the tools and guidance for that. We've recognized that, and that's why we've been working on this kind of concept around integrating responsible investment into defense-related companies. So, we can talk maybe some more about that later. So we've kind of written out, here's some of the things that we would look at from a company perspective, but it is definitely a challenge and a risk within that sector. Some of the big defense companies will sell into 160-plus countries. You can't run a screen on that kind of data. You can't run that on a live screen of these are all the destinations of across hundreds of companies and hundreds of countries and destination sites. So that's really where the due diligence piece needs to kind of come in, and the data and the engagement side with that.
On that, I mean, obviously data needs to come from a certain level of transparency and disclosure, unless you find alternative data sets that are not reported. And typically in defense, transparency is not necessarily what you typically find, because countries might not want to share, firms might not be particularly keen. So is this opening up on defense possible responsibly if we don't actually have the information to need to do that sort of due diligence that you're framing?
I think there is an element of transparency, and there has to be, but then there are elements of secrecy. But where those lines are drawn, I think, is something that can be explored. You know, if you look at where investors have paid attention in the past, none of the apparel companies wanted to say anything about where their supply chain was. And now you look at the companies that actually do detailed mapping all the way through their supply chain, right down to the production sites. And now some maybe the high-end brands still refuse to say where and where things are. There's issues with transparency across all different companies. And companies didn't voluntarily say, let's put all our financial accounts out there. It was only when they sort of were made to do that for various reasons. So yes, there may be transparency issues, but if investors actually combine to engage and ask the same sort of questions and are looking for the same sort of data points, or we can have those conversations maybe even with government, then there is potential there, I think, to address that issue.
Okay, thanks. You also mentioned earlier different kind of weapons categories, right? And I'm increasingly interested in understanding the dual use element, because someone recently mentioned to me, and I think I told you, that if we asked for Ukraine, what would be the two things that they would want to give up last to defend themselves? It would have been Starlink and Microsoft. So can we really look at this through the traditional eyes, or is dual use really much wider, and therefore trying to actually manage the role of defense in your portfolio becomes impossible?
I think this is why we've been focusing on the concept of defense-related companies in this initiative, the PRDI, as we've been calling it, Principles for Responsible Defense Investment, because people get sucked into this, the focus on the restrictions and the thresholds related to weapons. And a lot of it comes down to what's more important to you and what is your focus. Is it that you just don't want to make money from weapons? And that's perfectly valid, and that's a sort of fine position to take. Or actually, are you more concerned about conflict and harm and your connections to that? And that's much more aligned on the sort of the due diligence approach. Now, if it is conflict and harm, then actually, you know, a $10 billion big tech contract with a government is, and how what they're doing and the importance of that to conflict is probably more important than, say, the company that makes the widget that goes in the missile that goes into a ship and then never gets fired. Also, the lines between what is dual use, what is civilian use, what is tailored for military use and not, again, is slightly artificial because, again, is that company causing, contributing, or directly linked to harm? And what processes have they got in place to understand, identify, and act on those risks and impacts that they might be connected with on that side? So I think that's what we're trying to sort of push this argument as well, that yes, you can screen out things, and that's fine and legitimate, but fundamentally, if you really want to be meeting your own responsibilities as an investor and implement the OECD guidelines, et cetera, then you really need to be looking at that broader chain and focusing more on the due diligence elements about how it's designed, how it's developed, how it's produced, where it goes, how it's used, and underpinning all of that for all the defense-related stuff is, you know, is it used in line with international humanitarian law, the laws of armed conflict?
We talked about, I think, mainly weapons and a general sense, but we briefly touch controversial weapons. And I think there's been a change also by some investors in the market of looking at controversial weapons. Have you changed your view of controversial weapons? And, you know, is nuclear acceptable from that perspective?
I mean, controversial is not like a legal term, really. It's controversial is down to the individual side on that. I think there's big C controversial weapons, i.e. the definition given by, say, data providers, or and the EU has stepped in as well to say this is what we think is in the list and is not in the list. And depending on which data provider you go to, it may or may not include nuclear weapons in that side. I'd say nuclear weapons are small C controversial, but we wouldn't necessarily put them together with the kind of the big four of the other ones in terms of anti-personnel mines, cluster munitions, chemical and biological weapons. I mean, those ones are, you know, it's an incredibly complex area and there's a lot of debate around it. But the ones that you look at, anti-personnel mines, that you can argue can't be made and can't be used in line with international humanitarian law. And so they just shouldn't exist. And that's why the treaties on them are about, or the conventions are about, not producing, not stockpiling, and not using on those sides. Nuclear is more complex and has different nuance. So it's not that it isn't going to be treated by people as controversial, but maybe they exist in different buckets on that side. We still absolutely have a 0% threshold on those big four that I'm mentioning there. And then on nuclear, we still have a 0% threshold for companies connected to nuclear weapons. But we have that kind of potential to look on a case-by-case basis and by exception at companies and seen through that lens, because there's a lot of companies in that ecosystem behind it who aren't necessarily what you would call, say, a nuclear missile manufacturer or something like that.
I think, what's her name, Taylor Marjorie Greene in the US says, you know, we need to have individual personal arms to defend ourselves. It's interesting because I think countries that, like Finland, are now saying we need to have anti-mines to protect ourselves on the border with Russia. Is there a risk here where the sort of definition of things, at least from a country level, starts shifting beyond what, forget sustainable investment, investments traditional would have accepted? And do you see the investor community following?
There's still been investors because these companies were still been running, right? That make cluster munitions, that make anti-personnel mines. There's still capital, there's still finance flows around that. So depending on which investors they are and where they get involved on that side. I mean, there's five countries that have basically been saying, can we step back from this because we want to use anti-personnel mines? Not to get into their domestic defense policy, I don't think, 20 years down the line, if they cede their entire border with anti-personnel mines, I think they're going to come to regret that decision. I think if you look at what's been happening in Ukraine, et cetera, on that front, and the way that the Russians have operated in the past in relation to minefields, they're not the most effective thing that we have compared to the tech that is out there when it comes to border security. So I do think that that's a type of weapon that just shouldn't exist. And if you look at the numbers of deaths and why it was created and who actually gets killed by these, it's not soldiers, it's non-combatants, it's children. I don't think that's the right way to go on there. I think when I've looked at all the investors who have changed their stance on things, particularly in relation to sort of stuff in sustainable funds, anti-personnel mines, chemical and biological weapons, they're still well out, right? No one really wants to get involved in that. And I think that is an absolute red line for clients, for trustees, for beneficiaries, the whole lot. I don't think people will say, yeah, we think nerve gas is an appropriate thing for our pension to be invested in. That's a very different thing to saying we should be able to support a fishery protection vessel.
Yeah.
That's used by the Navy.
Great. And you mentioned other investors. What is your perspective of what's happening in the market more broadly? What have you seen investment manager or asset owners change, and in what directions? What are the levers?
I think definitely more permissive, you say, on that side for that. This bit chicken and egg, is it because there's an opportunity there because they've seen the defense stocks go up and now there's better revenue streams? I think we've gone through that big the big increase in the sort of the values on that side. And but with the increased defense expenditure, there are more consistent and stronger revenue sources coming through. So whether that's driving the element or whether it's more the positioning to say, actually defense is really, really important. And we think that's part of, not using a sustainable word here, but it is part of how we have that economic security and resilience. And therefore, we think it's an important thing to be involved in. I mean, these are the conversations we've had with several ones. Like, where are you actually drawing the lines? Because if you're an index investor and you just remove your restriction and you keep your nuclear restriction in place, chances are you're going to move your money into Chinese defense rather than US and European defense because of the connections to nuclear weapons that a lot of the big defense companies have. And so I think that's, if you're claiming this is to do with sort of regional security and resilience, then you kind of need to have a regional view on what you're doing with that. And I haven't seen that much nuance coming out. I've seen people saying, okay, we're removing our restrictions or relaxing our restrictions, but not many people coming out and taking that sort of geographic view on that side. We've chatted to quite a few investors who are doing more than to engage with the companies as well already. And they want to be having these conversations. And I think it's a case of, yes, you want investors to invest. You want responsible investors to invest in you, but there are conditions that come with that. And these are the expectations that we sort of have.
And looking at how the regulator has tried to intervene to clarify things on this topic, do you think that's been helpful?
I think both in the UK and in the EU, and they've said that, it's not irreconcilable, effectively, from a sustainable investment side. I think when, 100 MPs in the UK wrote to investors to say, you should invest in defence, or former prime ministers say there's nothing more ethical than defense kind of thing. I'm not sure that's always that helpful because it kind of places things in a quite binary position versus, how do you get investors to meet their responsibilities, like what the government expects under the National Action Plan on Business Human Rights? You know, how do investors meet those responsibilities whilst also supporting the industry and the sector on the side? It's a more nuanced argument for that, rather than just like pulling all the thresholds off and saying, yeah, go for it. Particularly when it comes back to that geographic point about, yes, you can say it's you might claim it's a sustainable investment, but whose defense are you investing in the first place?
Great, thanks. And I know that the Church of England Pension Board has also changed things. And I was reading yesterday a response of investors signaling there's some differences between what you guys have decided to do and them. Can you articulate those differences and why do you think those differences exist?
Well, we take the same theological advice. And we have the same conversations with the Ethical Investment Advisory Group on there. But fundamentally, we create our own policies agreed by our own trustees at our own boards, which is independent. And so we didn't know that that was coming until that was published. And that's the same for our ones. So if we ended up always making the same decisions from the same, that when we have different trustees, we have different investment horizons. We also have very different, you know, they operate to the Pensions Authority, we operate to the Charities Commission and have accountability to Parliament. I think it's right that we end up at slightly different positions on that side. And yeah, so they've taken a different approach for that. And they've reduced their thresholds from 10% to 5%. But there's not really any companies that fall between that 5 and 10% bracket either who aren't already covered in something else like small arms or nuclear weapons kind of restrictions on that side. So, yeah, they also, I would say, the Pensions Board have beneficiaries that they can survey and speak to mandates, whereas, you know, we have our fiduciary duty and how that kind of reflects in it. And if you go back into things like the Harry's judgments, which speak specifically around charity trustees and decision-making around kind of ethical dilemmas and how it's very hard to, you know, address something like this when there is a range of opinion and a range of views on it. And fundamentally, it comes down to what's in the best interest of the fund. So, you know, we just have different thought processes around a lot of these things.
Great. Thank you. Look, you mentioned twice now the principles for responsible defense investing. Can we double click on that? You know, who's behind it? What is it trying to achieve? Is it trying to tell us that investing in defense is sustainable?
No, it's very much not trying to tell anyone that it's a sustainable investment. And we're not saying it's an ethical investment on that side. It is about how do you integrate responsible investment principles into this broad range of defense-related companies, which is a sector that maybe hasn't had the attention previously because a lot of those, maybe say, responsible investors have either excluded or maybe ignored some of those downstream issues on that side. So we've been part of something called the Business and Conflict Community of Practice. There's lots of sort of experts in there from the Red Cross, from Peace Nexus, from PAX, broad range of largely civil society stakeholders and conflict and human rights experts. We've been part of that for a few years. We went out to a group and said, is any of you interested in helping us think through something that what this might look like? So we got about seven different expert voices in. We wrote a two-pager. I went, okay, I've got that now. I'll go out to some investors who we know have been grappling with this issue. Once we then had an equal balance, basically, of investors and expert voices, we then created that concept note that's been published, and maybe that can be shared in the comments and things. That sets out the context or the issues. We're not going to try and reconcile the irreconcilable. There's going to be those that want nothing to do with it. Those are going to be investing in everything. But if you've committed to responsible investment, what does that look like for this sector? So the concept note sort of sets out, here's what we could do, like the big, I can't put my arms that wide in the camera, but like the really broad scope. But where should we be focused? What are the needs of investors? And this is what we've been asking in that sort of November, December period in 25. And the idea then is to really help come up with either a set of principles or guidelines and then tools underneath that that will enable investors to really sort of bring that RI approach to those defense-related companies. And we've been very focused that it is defense-related to say that it's not just weapons companies, it is that defense tech space, it is those dual use and sometimes even civilian use or civilian products that we really should be focused on and how to address those companies. And particularly moving past this idea that the export licensing regime is the end of the story. And government says is okay, because that doesn't address the financial, the legal, the reputational, or the human rights risks that investors face when allocating capital to defense-related companies.
If you had to pick one thing from those defense principles that you find is critical to carry forward, what would that be?
So firstly, we haven't done the principles yet. So the concept note is a concept note. What's going to happen is, so if you think like Q1 26, we're basically going to be refining and saying this is what we're going to set the scope, because there's different implementation pathways, right, as well. So if you're just doing toolkits and guidance, you don't really need this massive governance structure around it. If you want a auditable global standards that has strong oversight and an ombudsman function, very unlikely to happen, but that is a totally different kind of prospect as well. And whether it's asset owner, asset manager, public, private, whether it's all of the value chain of defense, or whether it's just the operations and downstream due diligence piece. So all those bits need to come together before you then draft and consult on that guidance or those principles. But I think that the key part is that the due diligence elements, so what do we expect from investors and what do we expect from the companies in terms of whether the products and services are designed and used in line with international humanitarian law, and what process those companies have to do their own due diligence and demonstrate that they're meeting the expectations under international standards on business and human rights when it comes to the sale, resale, use or misuse of their products and services.
Cool. So how do you get, there's a lot to open, right? There seems to be most of the characteristics could take in different directions. How do people get involved, or who's making that decision, and can people get involved?
So we've asked who's keen. We've put out a sort of broad thing in terms of like for signups, for people to stay informed on that. At the moment, we've got this group of, say, 15 of us. There's the list actually in the back of the concept note that's got the various people that are involved and that have been named. So between us, we're going to listen to what everybody said, collate all that together, and then say, okay, this is the direction going forward. And then depending on the type of structure we need, so if we need, say, technical working group to sort of propose stuff, if we need a formal agreement body for the final version of the guidelines, then we'll set up that structure. But there might be then potential for other people to come in. One of the things that has been in the conversations in the last couple of months has been around, should this be broader than investors, and should it also wrap in financial institutions, insurance, who are also doing due diligence, who also have ongoing relationships with them? And so should it be broader than responsible investment, but narrower in terms of the due diligence on the operations and the downstream part? So it depends on what the scope and the ambition is set at. We'll then determine who else we need to kind of bring in. And then in the future, if there's things of, we're not going to say it's going to be investor commitments or anything, but of who might actually want to be part of that, it may lead on to things like collaborative engagements or individual engagements. So there's a lot of open questions on that side in the future.
Look, you also have been involved with the Investor Initiative on Human Rights Data. How much does that initiative come into this defense conversation? And how do you see data more generally being a critical component here? Is it working, or do you need a change?
So a big whiteboard with all the kind of overlapping circles, because I think these are kind of complementary theories of change, if you like, on there. But the Investor Initiative on Human Rights Data, which we lead with Aviva and Scottish Widows, where investors believe that how companies approach human rights is a financially material issue. We want to see better and broader human rights data on companies. And so we've been engaging with data providers, primarily focused on some core human rights data points, like have they got the policy commitment? Have they got due diligence? Have they got downstream? Have they got grievance and remedy mechanisms? So that's been on that side. There's an engagement stream on proxy advisors about how they understand human rights and how they integrate that data into their advice or recommendations. Obviously, this is a turbulent area in the last 18 months. And then our third bit of work was really around how companies are assessed in relation to international standards on business and human rights, or norms. And so when we talk about norms breach products or human rights controversies, we created a set of guidance for ESG data providers about how you can look at companies in terms of non-compliance or norms breaches for those companies. That's quite a critical part for this, because in terms of controversies and norms breach offerings, quite a few data providers have walked back their offerings for certain types of conflicts. So for instance, Sustainalytics calls it contiguous territorial disputes. And so any controversy or norms breach allegation or research has been sort of withdrawn for those kinds of conflicts. And this has happened across, you know, the major data providers, which has caused, you know, consternation amongst the investor community, because it removes data that enables us to do our human rights due diligence. And when it comes to defense-related companies, that's critical data that we need. I was on a webinar a while ago listening to an Article 8 ETF fund developer who explained that he had a defense-focused fund. And we asked the question of whether, you know, how the principal adverse impact indicators around the OECD guidelines and breaches of those would be integrated. He said, oh, we have a data provider, and that data provider tells us what the norms breaches are, and we exclude all those companies. I'm like, okay, but all those big data providers have removed the conflict-related data, which is the key data you need for a defense-related company. So there's a very strong overlap in terms of these issues that we're looking at. More broadly on data, you know, if I had the wish list or the mapping kind of piece was, if you click on, say, a company, British Aerospace or Rolls-Royce or something like that, you can then see here's where all of those their products go by type. And these are the conflicts they're being used in or being used in recently. And to start on that mapping, and then you can start seeing, okay, where there might be issues. But as with all of this data, it's the starting point for your due diligence, which might involve engaging with the company and having an informed discussion on that side. So, the two areas of work overlap and they kind of reinforce, but in segments, I'd say, rather than completely.
And I guess this is all what in lingo is the Kaharas, you know, the conflict affected and high risk areas. And I thought this is basically where the UN guiding principles ask for those to be looked at in due diligence. And what you're saying, I think, is that that's now hard to find.
And yes, it's some of the data around those areas. So it depends on how the data provider has defined it, because the territorial dispute, so CARAs or conflict affected high risk areas are broader than just territorial disputes. So you might have some data, but you might not have other data, depending on what it is. So, you know, Crimea is a really interesting example where it might be classed as, a territorial dispute on that side. But understanding what's happening to the businesses in there, particularly in the future with peace deals, et cetera, is quite important. For that element. So, and just for those listening, the UN guiding principles on business human rights say that you should really do more. You should heighten your due diligence in conflict affected and high risk areas. And so it's an expectation to do more and understand, for instance, how you might be connected to the conflicts through the companies or their products and services on that side. So CARA means have more due diligence, which means have better data than you might need for just, say, you know, a tech company that produces widgets or something.
I wanted to switch, and I know you actually have this as part of your remit. You mentioned it at the start, to AI and tech.
You're going broad today.
Yes. But obviously broad, but I think narrow. I mean, if you think about the war in Ukraine, it's a tech war in a sense. I just think of the drones flying around. How do you see AI from that perspective? You know, is it kind of like a negative force, a positive force, a force to manage? And how do you manage it in your specific role? Because you mentioned that you're looking at responsible tech.
All wars are tech wars. There's just the evolution in the latest sort of technology. I mean, and all wars are horrible. Things have changed with Ukraine in terms of it's the first sort of drone war, and that's on the ground, in the air, in the sea. There are three battle space areas where there's drones, and there is a lot of warfare that is happening on the social media side. There's a lot on the cyber piece, the cyber attacks and things that go with it. So it is very much at the leading edge, if you like, of the tech side on there. And so AI is just a part of that in the same way that, you know, when the first soldiers saw a tank come over the trench in World War One, it's like, oh, it's a new bit of technology. But we weren't really okay. It's the petrol engine war, or it's the armor war and stuff that goes with it. So I think we get sucked in, and I think there's a lot of AI boosters that really want to suck people in as well into this conversation. But fundamentally, the same things are there, right? Are these things designed to be used in line with IHL, and are they used in line with IHL? So international humanitarian law and the laws of armed conflict, and so that's the whole part with all of the AI stuff. Now, some of it might reduce what they call that kill chain. They might make it more efficient to do things. Some actually may make it better in terms of targeting, i.e. and having, you know, less collateral damage that goes with it. So there can be better outcomes in one direction, but definitely worse outcomes for what's on the other side. But I'd say it's like with all technological advances, whoever's got a leading edge is going to have an advantage on it. But as we've seen with conflicts, you know, Afghanistan, etc., it's not the high tech that necessarily outlasts on that side. And it's not a drone war. It's not an AI war. It's a people war, because wars are always about people and by people. And fundamentally, they're going to be the big difference for this.
How are you engaging on AI with companies in your role?
I think in general, you know, as we are relatively small asset owner, and we, for our size, we have a big team, but there's limits to how much you can actually do, which is why when we have a theme that we want to focus on, so responsible tech, for instance, we try and do collaborative engagements with broader groups to increase the impact. So we've been part of the World Benchmarking Alliance's AI KIC, Collaborative Impact Coalition, which won a couple of awards recently on that side. So they've been looking at a lot of the biggest tech companies in the world, and it's been a program for a few years of engagement related to responsible AI principles and then the integration of human rights into that. So we've been engaging with several companies for a while now on that side as part of that broader collaboration and coalition. And it is that, you know, how do you bring that human rights principle to the companies when they're looking at tech, i.e. what are the risks and impacts in relation to your decisions and your products and your services, and how can we advance and have conversations and encourage companies to meet their, you know, expectations under international standards as well on that side. So that's kind of one of the areas. There's been some other stuff as well. There's a whole Swedish collaboration that's focused on the big tech companies. But there are questions in my head personally about how stewardable, should we say, some of these big tech companies are, because they are so big and they have so many investors, and their ability to give attention to minority investors can be quite limited.
Great. So as part of the show, we ask our guests to bring a piece of art that can help communicate the role of sustainability or defense, as we discussed today. So we were curious to hear what you got to share.
So I haven't got it with me, but it's about this shape, actually. And it's in the Louvre at the moment. And despite my best efforts with a ladder and a car, I couldn't cover it because it's quite large. It's something called the Memorial Cone of the Meslim Treaty. And it's about 4,500 years old. And it's sort of in that Mesopotamian region. It was a marker that was put down. And it's cultural heritage, it's art, but realistically, it's the kind of the first sort of written international arbitration treaty between two warring little small states who basically spent a couple hundred years fighting over a little patch of land that was, you know, exceptionally fertile, that had irrigation ditches in amongst that sort of, if we think of modern day Iraq and around that area. So it's kind of fascinating because it's a, you know, they were fighting over like grain, if you like, and water. So some of the earliest recorded things we think about in terms of conflicts are in relation to natural resources and access to them. But then fundamentally, one, they kind of sort of dominated the other for a little while. And then they were gobbled up by the Akkadian Empire, which is like the first sort of empire we have a record of. Then a couple hundred years later, that entire empire basically vanished due to climate change. And the whole thing was sort of gone. And it just is how it kind of builds into all this thing around sustainability and defense. And what you have is this sort of arbitrated agreement where they say, here's the marker, you have this bit of land, you have this bit of land, and we'll do a deal on that side. And all the effort that went into it, and fundamentally the climate change came along and wiped out all of those ambitions and made everyone leave the land anyway on that side. So it's more to go back. We've been doing these kind of things for 4,500 years in terms of conflict and fighting over things. But fundamentally, if nature comes along and has its own say, then it can sort of change and make everything else sort of moot as well. So something I was always to bear in mind about what's lurking in the background behind geopolitics is the fact that the planet might come over and have its own own voice in the argument.
Amazing. I really like that. Sustainability, defense come together in different ways, but they can kind of trump each other depending on what moment you are in history. So thanks.
Yeah.
Look, to end off, there's a couple of quick fire questions we'd like to ask. And I'll kick off with transparency of arms shipment. Is that smart or dumb?
Smart. So how long have we got for the answers? Like, is it?
Oh, very short. Smart is perfect. Okay. I mean, if you have smart. A couple of things you want to say, that's fine.
I'll go for smart. That's right.
Great. And nuclear weapons, controversial, yes or no?
Small C, controversial.
Great. Defense drones, good or bad?
Good if designed and operated in line with IHL, bad if not.
Human rights due diligence in defense, realistic or fantasy?
Everything's a fantasy until it becomes a reality. So I think it's my realistic fantasy, which might try and make happen with that PRDI thing.
And public sentiment on defense investing in 2026. Warming or cooling?
Depends where you live.
Look, I'll leave it there. Dan, this has been great for me. I've learned a lot. I thought I had figured it all out. I didn't, so thank you. If I had to kind of say a takeaway, it seems that there is a discussion that investor has to have around their choices on defense and if they want to do it and how they want to do it. But there's on the why, I think there's certain things that you just cannot reconcile the irreconcilable. So that's something that needs to happen at each investor stage. But if and when you decide that there is something, I think what you've highlighted a lot today is how can this be done? And some of the things you're involved in, these principles for responsible defense investing, the initiative on human rights data seems to be tooling that investors that are listening can leverage on to kind of think of once you've decided to do this, how you can do this. So I would point the listeners to, you know, the material about these two initiatives and to get involved and to join if possible. But by and large, I think 2026 is this conversation continues to be live, and I think it's going to be an important discussion for sustainable investing. And as you said, it might not be a sustainable investment, but there's certainly something around being a responsible investor in this. And I think this, I hope this episode has helped. So Dan, thanks very much for joining.
Thanks. Really good fun.
It was great.
Catch you later.
Yeah, it was great. And look, thanks also for Curtis File for all the work in the background, for the Earworm team for producing the show. If you like this episode, please like, subscribe, and comment. And we do hope to see you on the next show. And in the meantime, stay wired.